In the words of my late friend Aretha Franklin, show some R-E-S-P-I-C-T.
How dare you?
Wow. Hi there. Welcome into the morning edition, the Monday morning edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. They're all morning editions. Trust me, I get up really early. Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host for this hour of observation, insight, and absurdity, hoping that you had a great weekend and that you're up, roaring, ready to go on a Monday morning. Hey, you survived a weekend. You made it to another Monday. Get your feet under you, plant yourself, and get ready, because it's going to get crazy. It just is. It is, just life in America today, quite honestly. As we watch the news around us, as we see what's happening, as we learn the various things that our government is doing and not doing, and who they are doing it for and who they're not doing it for. And then you look at the situation around the world, and you have to acknowledge, this is the greatest country in the world to live in. And then you hear politicians on the stump trying to become the next president of the United States, talking about how America just basically sucks and we need to elect them to fix it. If we don't elect them, then doggone it, they can't transform the country. And you know, that's what the leftists are all about. They want to transform America. Bernie Sanders even said so. Remember, when a politician talks about transforming the country you live in, it means that he and those who promote him do not love the country you live in. They want to make it into something else. Because love doesn't transform. It restores. Good to have you in on this Monday. After that first little thing. Wowzer. It is, I'm looking around here. I've got a big list of things to get into. I know I'm not going to get into all. I never get into everything. Trust me, I just never get into everything. That's just how it works. And what else is there? Technical issues? No technical issues. But I did have one scary thing happen over the weekend. And if you're a regular listener to the podcast, you know that many mornings I'll start the podcast off by talking about the weird computer stuff I've had going on. And honestly, I'm not whining about this. It's just that, you know, I count myself blessed to have the tech at hand to be able to do what I do, because I don't just sit down in front of my iPhone and yammer. I don't just sit down in front of my, in front of my laptop and talk. I have a studio. And I've had a studio for quite some time because my field of work has been in the broadcast industry. And I've done voiceover work.
You too can save big bucks at John's Auto Supply.
I've done all kinds of stuff. And as a result, over the years, I've built a little studio to do that stuff with. I've recorded things for people I've worked for. I've recorded things for my own income. I've just have a little studio set up. I have a little bitty Behringer X1222 USB mixer that when I bought it was just like woo, but it's not anymore. And I have a big 10 year old 27 inch iMac computer sitting in front of me that I dare not run some programs on because it'll just look at me and say, I'm sorry, but I'm done now. Just dig a hole in the backyard and bury me, because it really can't handle the current software. I just use it for web browsing, basically. And I've got a Word doc open on one side, a Pages document open on one side with all of my story links. And then I've got a browser, and I may open a recording program to snag something on it from time to time, but I don't do much more than that. I edit audio on it. That's not all that demanding. Over to my left, about 6 feet away, maybe a bit further away, is my 8-year-old MacBook Pro that once was the workhorse. That was my only computer and my workhorse, and I've had it for all this time. And it's my video editing workstation, because I do a little bit of video work as well. And above it is a 4K monitor that came along at some point, and that's so I can watch the end result of the videos in full 4K resolution. And then over to my right
there is a there's the effects bank. The effects bank. Yeah, I should take a picture of this and post it today, because to call it an effects bank is like calling a Volkswagen Beetle a sports car. It's just not. Come on. It's one unit. It's a DBX 286S that processes the microphone so that I don't sound strange. Here, let me take it out. Here. Okay. This is me with it. This is me without it. It just makes everything sound better. And it does that by eliminating. Listen. You hear the hiss? That's everything in the room, because the microphone picks everything in the room up. That's fans and computers. That's the air moving around the room. Maybe even the dog in the chair behind me snoring. But I use the processor to block all of that out and to put a little EQ on the voice. And what else is there? Oh, to the left of the iMac, there's another monitor. I think it's a 24-inch 1080. And by the way, these are Scepter monitors. I got them on Amazon. They were cheap. So it's not like I spent tons of money on them. And to the right of the iMac, there's my iPad, which contains all of the oddball things that I drop in.
God bless America.
That kind of stuff. And from time to time,
everything is racing.
All little songs and things like that. They're all loaded up on the iPad. And then another iPad directly above it, which is so old.
How old is it?
It's so old. It's so old. I can only really use it as a digital clock now. Because it's just, it won't. I tried loading the latest version of Waze. You know, the travel app, Waze. I tried to put Waze on this iMac. On this iPad. It said, not on this iPad, you're not, because it's too old. It won't run it. It just won't. And it's one that has 3G. 3G service. Okay, that's 3G. That's before 4G. That's before LTE. It has 3G service on it. And what gets me is Verizon still charging me every month to use this thing, and all I use it for is a clock. And I got to have a talk with Verizon. And then what else is there? Oh, just to the, just above, sitting next to there's a Mac Mini, by the way, that's below the DBX, the voice processor. There's a Mac Mini, and it handles all the PSAs and the stuff that runs in the breaks that the people on Facebook live hear, but podcast subscribers don't. And it, the bumper music and everything comes out of the Mac Mini. Another thing I got really cheap on, where did I get it? eBay. I bought it on eBay. And then there's the AT&T UVerse receiver sitting next to it, and I use that because I like to keep the news up while I'm working. Today, that's not happening, and that's because for some reason AT&T UVerse will run for 13 seconds. Yes, I timed it. It will run for 13 seconds and then freeze, and I can change channels, and the other channel will run just fine for 13 seconds, and then it will freeze. And so there's something bad going on with AT&T UVerse, and I don't know if it's in the neighborhood. I have two receivers, the upstairs receiver and the downstairs receiver. They both do the same thing. So it's the service. It's not my equipment in the house. It's the service. So something weird is going on. And today, when we finish up here, Mr. Mark will be on the telephone with somebody in the Philippines, because that's where the call center is, I think, and talking with somebody about my AT&T UVerse service here in the state of Alabama, which still makes no sense to me at all, but hey, you do what you got to do, AT&T. Thanks for keeping it in the U.S. of A, guys. And that's it. I have a little studio set up, and all of it has been acquired bit by bit, piece by piece, over the years. Oh, I forgot, there's one more thing. There's the JBLM patch. That's a little gizmo down here sitting in front of the keyboard, between the keyboard and the iMac. And that is, it's a speaker selector is what it is. I can feed all of the different things into it and just press buttons to determine what I want to hear on the speakers. And that's what that's for. And the headphones are plugged into it. And there's some little, what else? I've got a handful of IKEA desk lamps that I've picked up at thrift stores for $3 to $5 a piece over the years. these little gooseneck things. They're LED lamps that are just so bright they'll blind you. But and that's the studio. Oh, and the leg lamp. I've got the leg lamp. Maybe I should have had a little more coffee or should have stayed in bed a little longer. I don't know. Anyway, but I don't really have any big issues today. I have, as you've heard, I've got a lot of tech in here, and everything I've named off is basically part of what I do every day. And when one of those little pieces of equipment goes haywire, it throws a big wrench in the works. And fortunately, nothing is going on. But I did have a scare. I think I started telling you the story. I did have a scare with the MacBook Pro over the weekend. And that was that I got this notice about an update. And if you don't have an Apple computer, then you don't know. But Apple is constantly, and I mean constantly, updating its software. And that's a good thing. From time to time, it's like, seriously, again? But it's a good thing because that means you've always got the latest version that will run on your equipment. As your equipment gets older, that becomes a little restrictive because the newest versions can't run on the older equipment because you don't have the right chips to make it run right. So they can't do that. But my MacBook Pro is running Catalina, which is the latest version of the operating system. And I got a little notice that kept nagging me. There's an update available. And I don't ever update during the week because I need time. I want to have that time in case anything goes wrong. So Saturday, after I got back in from my Saturday morning adventures with my buddy Mike, I walked through the studio and decided, let's update that MacBook right now. And I got plenty of time to recover from anything. Thank goodness I did, because everything went crazy. Everything went nuts. It's hard to describe. It rebooted after the update, and then both of the screens went haywire. The big 4K monitor turned completely green, like a bright green, like a green screen, a background, you know, for shooting composite video. And the MacBook screen just had a bunch of lines across it, just like long dashes and stuff, and they were slowly changing, like it was trying to paint the image that was there, but it couldn't. And after a while, I finally gave up. There was nothing I could do. I was desperate, and so I have a USB drive that has an installer for an older version of the operating system on it, and so I plugged it in and decided just to reinstall the operating system. And in midstream, I thought better of it, or just a few seconds after I plugged it in, I realized that I should have done something else, and I stopped it, and nothing changed. What changed was when I unplugged the big monitor, the 4K monitor, I disconnected it, and all of a sudden, everything went back to normal again, which I've never heard of, I've never seen, and it freaked me out. This is the third time this has done this, by the way. If that little guy goes away, that's the most advanced computer I have. If that one goes away, I can't edit video. There's a lot of stuff I can't do anymore. I can't edit photos. I can't, because the one in front of me won't do it. So I'm up the creek, and I'm up to the creek to the tune of close to $4,000, because that's what it would take to replace that little gem right there. But that's the way the weekend went. So it was a big scare, and fortunately, everything is okay now. It's running fine, like it always does. It's got OBS up, which is feeding Facebook Live. It's got Audio Hijack up, which is recording the podcast for the podcast subscribers, and it's working just fine. I edited some video. I made sure everything was working okay, but it did scare me. It's happened three times now. And when that kind of thing starts happening, it's expensive, to the tune of, well, if I send this in, Apple's going to charge me probably a minimum of $800. They're going to send it off to Texas. They're going to have a look at it and say, yep, got to replace the logic board, which is the motherboard for you PC users. And in order to do that, it's an $800 pop. And that's just like, whoa, That's not happening. If I'm going to spend $800 on fixing a computer, got to be honest with you, I'm going to go shopping for a secondhand one. And when I shop for a secondhand one, I find older ones than the one I have now in that price range. Let's say $800 to $1,200, something like that. I might as well just drop $3,900 on a new one. And I would have to drop that much in order to outfit it, in order to do what I do with this thing every day. What an interesting way to start a podcast, huh? I spent the first several minutes, the entire first segment, talking about how I had freaked out because my computer went down over the weekend. But when it's part of what you do every day, you're going to freak out, I guess. I know I did.
Yeah, man, I tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just going on there and pointing, click, 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 click. It's real easy, man.
It really is easy. Too easy in some cases. Hi there, Mark Congleton here. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast. Hopefully I didn't run you off with segment one. It's Monday. What I got to say? Oh, it's Monday. Well, one of the news stories that hit us over the weekend, the coronavirus is spreading. A dozen Italian towns have gone into lockdown after a growing cluster of coronavirus cases were detected and two people infected with the disease died. Authorities in the Lombardy and Veneto regions closed schools, businesses, and restaurants in response to the outbreak. Scheduled sporting events and church services were also canceled. Attilio Fontana, the president of Lombardy, said there were 39 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the region, and 10 towns there were ordered to suspend non-essential activities. A 77-year-old woman in the region tested positive for the virus after her death, but it's not yet known whether the virus was the cause of her death. None of the infected people in Lombardy have visited China, but at least 15 of them are believed to have frequented the same bar and had the same group of friends, according to the New York Post. It's believed that the first man who was infected with the virus in Lombardy met with a friend who had visited China. The cases in Lombardy are the first known cases of local transmission in Italy. According to Veneto Regional President Luca Zaia, 12 people in the region have been infected with the virus, two of whom are confirmed relatives of a 78-year-old man who died with the infection on Friday. The man was from a small town 30 miles southeast of Padua, and was hospitalized for 2 weeks prior to his death. Zaya said, "The local transmissions in the small town show the virus is spread just like any flu." According to the AP, he says, "You can get it from anyone. We can expect to have cases of patients who had no contact with people suspected of carrying the disease or with links to China." While contagious, the virus is only particularly lethal for the elderly or people with existing medical conditions. The first case of coronavirus also appeared in the Piedmont region of Italy on Saturday when a man fell ill after coming in contact with the Lombard stock. That's according to Sky TG24. It's not a Piedmontese outbreak, but a Lombard one, a regional counselor for health, Luigi Icardi, said. Public offices in Milan were also closed on Saturday, but events like Milan Fashion Week, they're continuing as normal. Carlo Capassa, he's the president of the Italian National Fashion Chamber, told the AP, "It doesn't seem to me in this moment, for what regards our sector, our Fashion Week, that there are signs of danger. We are tranquil and prudent." Adding the case in the Piedmont region as of Saturday, there were at least 55 coronavirus infections nationwide, 39 in Lombardy, 12 in Veneto, 3 in Rome, 1 in Piedmont. This all coming from the Western Journal. The virus itself, there's so much speculation about the virus, about its origins, and there is so much lack of knowledge. It's actually a frightening thing. But please, remember what I said at the very beginning when this started to become a story. And that is that last year in 2019, or was it 2018? Anyway, last year, in the United States of America, 6,000 people, 6,000 people died from the flu. The influenza virus. Preventable by going to your local drugstore and getting a flu shot. Or when you go see your doctor and they bug you, have you had your flu shot? Just tell them, yeah, okay, go ahead. Poke me. It's preventable. 6,000 people died. We have stories. I've seen three different stories, different places, different labs, different universities, which have stepped up and said, yeah, we've tested the coronavirus and we have found a way to kill it. I don't know what the progress is in any of those areas. I've seen three, as I said, three different stories touching on three different labs, three different universities, three different stories saying they can do something about this. And I don't know what's happening with that. I would just say that we should not panic. We should never panic. But we should be wise. At this point in time, I got to be honest, I wouldn't travel outside the U.S. That sounds pretty severe. It sounds extreme. And I've had friends tell me, I think you could probably be safe. That's exactly what I'm thinking. I want to be safe. Because you don't know where anybody's been. If you've got a trip to Southeast Asia, anywhere in that area, and now Europe, it would probably be wise to reschedule that until after they've gotten a handle on this. And don't give up on it. By all means, don't give up on it. I've told the story. My wife and I have been trying to plan a vacation for a while. We have an opportunity. It's been a blessing that we've been given an opportunity to take a trip, and we're going to. And we had already, we'd been on the verge of actually dropping the coin, getting ready, putting the deposit down on a cruise. And a family member, a dear family member of ours, was diagnosed with cancer, and she was going through all of the processes, the chemo, the whole nine yards, the radiation, everything, and there's going to be surgery. It's breast cancer, so there's going to be removal surgery, and she's been going back and forth about the process and where she wants to have this done and if she wants that done, and we're not going to make a decision on anything about our vacation until this person is on the other side of this experience and is stable. We're going to be here because this person is like a child, one of our own children. So I mean, she's our first priority, not taking a vacation. But even as I look at things and we're getting closer to that point where we can make that decision, I'm not inclined to go any place that puts me in an enclosed environment with a bunch of other people. So odds are Jane and I will not be going on a cruise anytime soon. And I started exploring other options, thinking, well, what about maybe Vegas? We've never been there, would like to go. What about New York City? I'm not all that hot about going, but Jane's always wanted to go see New York City, so okay. That's a possibility. There are other places we could go. We could do a Disney trip. We haven't done one of those in a few years. Maybe go to California. It's been nearly 10 years since we've been to Disneyland. We might go back out there and see all the stuff that's changed and do some sightseeing that we didn't have time to do the last time we were there. And then it hit me. I was talking with someone about the possibilities, and they said, I don't think I'd get on a plane. With all the recirculated air and you never know who any of those people are or where they've been. I sure wouldn't get on a plane. So now we're down to where we're going to drive. Wow. We did that a few years ago, kind of the staycation thing. We never went anywhere that was more than a one-night stay away. It was just a week. You know, we spent a week where one day we got in the car and we went to someplace. And, you know, we spent each day doing that. And then we ventured out and went into the Nashville area and ended up spending a night in a hotel and went a few places there. But I just don't know about that. At any rate, be wise, be cautious, but don't be foolishly afraid of the situation. At this point, it's a mystery what's going on. At this point, we're not being told everything, which of course is creating a lot of speculation. And it's creating a lot of the conspiracy theories that you keep hearing about a biological weapons lab being located right there just outside of Wuhan province in China, where this all happened. So we really don't know what's happening. We don't know if it was engineered or it came from animals, which is what they keep saying. Well, the only rational conclusion is that it came from bats. I think that's kind of a batty answer myself, but hey, you do you. I would just say, take the conspiracy stuff with a grain of salt. Don't take it seriously until there's actual, real confirmation.
Yeah, you're funny, all right. You're a scream. You ought to get a job on one of those excursion boats.
Well, if I could, I would, but, you know, seasickness. Hi there. It's the Monday edition of the Daily Perspective. Mark Congleton here, turning my studio speakers off. That's the latest Huey Lewis thing. I saw the video the other day. I said, wow, that's great bumper stuff there. It is February 24th, Monday, the 24th day of February, 2020. And back to the coronavirus. Seriously, don't panic. Just be smart. And do your homework, and don't let people panic you. But also realize that we're probably never going to know. Honestly, no one in an official capacity is ever going to tell us the truth about where this came from. Because there are so many relationships, so many little things politically that they consider when they let you know things. And that's not paranoia. That's just track record is what that is. And that's pretty much all I have to say about that. Just be smart. Okay. Just be smart. Where were we? Oh yeah. I got sidetracked during the break. I always do this. I'm scanning social media and, from about 2 years ago, you know, Facebook cares about your memories. There was something that I posted that Bill Whittle posted on Facebook. And I'm going to kind of sidetrack here for a moment. I've got a story coming up about someone who has mysteriously died that I want to bring to you. But first, this. Bill Whittle on Facebook, he gets he's been defending gun ownership. And he gets this response that says, I hope someone you love will die from a mass shooting so you'll use the money you get from the NRA for the funeral. And his response is, if I or someone I love dies in a mass shooting, that will not change my opinion on the matter in the slightest, you self-satisfied, hate-filled moron. I know that's hard for you to believe, but what would someone like you know about principles? 8,000 black Americans are murdered every year in this country, and with virtually zero exceptions, they are dying in places where your philosophy and political party, not mine, have been running the show for 50, 70, 100 years and more. These areas have the strictest gun control measures in the country. There is a word for this kind of statement, and that word is evidence. 50 years ago, anyone could walk into a hardware store in America and walk out with as many guns as they could carry. Almost every high school in the country had shooting clubs on campus. It was much easier to get a gun 50 years ago, but no mass shootings back then. That's even better evidence. But I learned a long time ago that details like that are utterly meaningless to you. Not when you have such a full virtue signaling schedule to maintain. Not only has there never been a more ignorant generation than yours, there has never, in all of human history, been a generation so proud of how stupid they are. Know why we have these horrors today, Genius A student? Do you know what has changed in the last half century? We didn't have these massacres back then because your progressive philosophy hadn't yet had the time to destroy every moral structure in the country yet. That's why. What progressivism has done to America, and most especially what it has done to black families and churches in inner city America, is simple genocide, and it depends on people like you to promote and defend it. I, for one, have had enough. In fact, I had enough 10 years ago when I started this. So, piss off, pseudo-person, and take your stupidity signaling someplace where other self-righteous room-temperature intellects will give you the attention you so deeply require. Wow, good for Bill Whittle. And he nails it. I mean, center of the bullseye. He absolutely scores. Because everything he says here is it's absolute truth. 50 years ago in America, teachers were not handcuffed and chained by the federal government. And they cared so much and were able to execute what they cared about in class. They were able to teach morality, not moral relativism. They were able to teach real American history, not the opinions of progressives about American history. They were able to guide students and keep them out of the ditches of life without being sued by angry parents. We lived in a different world then. Progressivism has destroyed the culture of this nation, starting with inner cities controlled by Democrat politicians. It's a very, very sad thing. A very, very sad thing. If you've ever wondered what happened to America, and if you were my age, you look around you and wonder when the country went insane. And I do from time to time. And it's not just because I'm an old guy. It's because everything has changed drastically in my lifetime. When I was a kid, parents taught their children to be polite. When I was a kid, we were taught to say yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. We were taught manners. We were taught to respect the people who were older than us because they had real life experience and we could only guess at life. But progressives came along and started teaching kids you can't trust those people older than you because they don't know what it's like to be you and to live today. Which is, when you think about it, probably one of the dumbest things ever thought of. Because those people older than you have already been your age and already faced your challenges for the most part. Because honestly, human nature doesn't change. And what people will and won't do because of human nature doesn't change. The tools, the methods, yeah, those change. But the core of it all doesn't. So elderly people have knowledge you don't have because they've been through things you haven't experienced. And to discount their knowledge because they're older than you, because they have gray hair, to call them boomer, is to actually exercise stupidity at the highest level. And when somebody says to me, okay, boomer, or yeah, whatever, I look at them and say, you know what that really means? That really means that's okay, buddy. I'd rather be stupid. Because that's what it really means. Okay, back to the stories. Up next in the stack, you probably heard about this already, but here we go. Philip Haney, he's a Department of Homeland Security whistleblower. He was an outspoken critic of the administration of the former President Barack Obama. Friday, about 40 miles east of Sacramento, California, found dead on the side of the road. 66-year-old Haney appeared to have suffered a single, self-inflicted gunshot wound, according to the Amador County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff and coroner Martin Ryan shared the initial details of the case, saying on February 21, 2020, at approximately 10-12 hours, deputies and detectives responded to the area of Highway 124 and Highway 16 in Plymouth to the report of a male subject on the ground with a gunshot wound. Upon their arrival, they located and identified 66-year-old Philip Haney, who was deceased and appeared to have suffered a single self-inflicted gunshot wound. A firearm was located next to Haney and his vehicle. This investigation is active and ongoing. No further details will be released at this time. Haney was recently in contact with DHS officials about a possible return to the agency. That's what the Washington Examiner's reporting, and they add that he was also engaged to be married. So, he's engaged to be married. That's a good turn in life. That's a good thing. Something to be very happy about. The government agency that once employed him before he got stabbed in the back by the Obama administration, now under the guidance and control of sane people, has offered him a job. That's another good thing. Life is good. But for some reason, they expect us to believe he ended it all. In June 2016, Haney testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, where he alleged that the Obama-era DHS had ordered him to delete hundreds of files, files about reputed associates of Islamic terror groups. Haney made the case that several attacks in the U.S. could have been prevented if some of those files had not been deleted. Writing in The Hill in February of 2016, Haney claimed that Obama had thrown the U.S. intelligence community under the bus for failing to connect the dots after a Nigerian Muslim terror suspect was linked to a failed terror plot on Christmas Day in 2009. Haney wrote, referring to Obama, "Most Americans were unaware of the enormous damage to morale at the Department of Homeland Security, where I worked, that his condemnation caused. His words infuriated many of us because we knew his administration had been engaged in a bureaucratic effort to destroy the raw material, the actual intelligence we had collected for years, and erase those dots. The dots constitute the intelligence needed to keep Americans safe, and the Obama administration was ordering they be wiped away. The dots that connected things that we discussed before." Haney, who worked for the DHS for about 15 years, was also the author of See Something, Say Something, A Homeland Security Officer Exposes the Government's Submission to Jihad. In November, Haney contacted the Examiner about plans to publish a sequel to the book. He retired in 2015, studied Arabic culture and language while working as a scientist in the Middle East before becoming a founding member of DHS in 2002 as a Customs and Border Protection Agriculture Officer. Life was good. Engaged, going to be married, offered a great new job. But for some reason, We're expected to believe he blew his own brains out.
They looked at me as if I had lobsters crawling out of my ears.
Welcome to my life. It's the final segment of this Monday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. The 24th day of February, 2020. Mark Congleton here, driving the bus through Crazy Town. And it's really good to have you along. Thank you so much for being there. Well, Bernie Sanders is taking the lead now when it comes to the Democrat presidential race. The clown car is getting roomier as days go by, as more people are dropping out of the race and everything is turning around. God love him, Joe Biden, as I said when he first declared, was going to have a rough time because he was going to have people policing him the whole time to keep him on message, to keep him from veering from the talking points was one thing, and to keep him from touching people, because he does have that name, that nickname, Creepy Uncle Joe, because he can't seem to keep his hands off of people. Well, God love him, it's caught up with him. And now, moving out front, way ahead of him, by the way, Bernie Sanders, the communist. Yes, I call him a communist, because honestly, when you look at what he really believes and the people he has actually praised, it's beyond socialism. It really is. He is the front runner in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. And he attacked the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, yesterday. And was subsequently condemned by the organization. Sanders took to Twitter and wrote, "The Israeli people have the right to live in peace and security. So do the Palestinian people. I remain concerned about the platform AIPAC provides for leaders who express bigotry and oppose basic Palestinian rights. For that reason, I will not attend their conference." Sanders concluded, "As president, I will support the rights of both Israelis and Palestinians to do everything possible to bring peace and security to the region." And if you believe that, I've got some prime development land in Central Florida, around Lake Okeechobee, I'd like you to look at. AIPAC responded in a statement, writing, "Senator Sanders has never attended our conference, and that is evident from his outrageous comment. In fact, many of his own Senate and House Democratic colleagues and leaders speak from our platform to the over 18,000 Americans from widely diverse backgrounds, Democrats, Republicans, Jews, Christians, African-Americans, Hispanic-Americans, progressives, veterans, students, members of the LGBTQ plus community, who participate in the conference to proclaim their support for the U.S.-Israel relationship. By engaging in such an odious attack on this mainstream bipartisan American political event, Senator Sanders is insulting his very own colleagues and the millions of Americans who stand with Israel," AIPAC concluded. "Truly shameful." Sanders has surrounded himself with fringe far-left voices, ranging from members of Congress to activists, who have extensive histories of documented anti-Semitism. The most prominent anti-Semites that Sanders has surrounded himself with on his campaign include Socialist Representatives Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and the far-left activist Linda Sarsour. Socialist Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who walks in lockstep with Omar and Tlaib, but is more careful with her words, is also campaigning for Sanders. Omar, who is among the most notorious anti-Semites in the country, responded with Sanders' attack on AIPAC with glee, writing, "Thank you, Bernie Sanders, for standing up for Palestinian human rights. All candidates should follow Bernie's example and skip AIPAC." The Daily Wire reported last year, "Sanders supports a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and has often been very hostile to Israel's defensive measures against the radical Islamic terrorism that engulfs the Jewish state on all sides." While running for president in 2016, Sanders cited a blatantly false number of Palestinian Arab deaths that had allegedly resulted from the 2014 Gaza Strip war between the two sides. Sanders' repeated hostility towards Israel has led some to predict that if he becomes the Democratic nominee, Trump will win a majority of Jewish voters. New York Times columnist Barry Weiss even agrees with the assessment. He said, she said to a tweet by John Levine, John Levine said, if Sanders is the nominee, Trump will win a majority of Jewish voters. Screenshot this tweet. And then Barry Weiss says that is correct. Sanders' contempt for Israel spilled over during his recent CNN town hall last week when he falsely accused Israel's government of being racist. Sanders was asked, how do U.S.-Israel relations look under your administration? He responded, to be for the Israeli people and be for peace in the Middle East does not mean that we have to support right-wing, racist governments that currently exist in Israel. Wow. Of course he drops the R word. Of course he drops racism. Why?
Everything is racist!
Everything has to be racist for the left. That is the dirty label they have to put on people in order to make you very uncomfortable with them. But Bernie should be questioned in everything he does. Because his prior statements, his prior things, the things that he has said in the past are indications of his true colors. My friend Ray Melick posted on Facebook something that I need to pass along to you. And the link is in the show notes today. And he links to another article, which you need to read. But let me just read you what Ray said. From this article, quote, Bernie Sanders likes to beat up on people for various votes they've taken in the past. To support the Iraq War, for instance, or to endorse George W. Bush. Fair enough. I suppose that if you want to draw terminal conclusions about a politician's judgment for a vote made a decade ago, using the assistance of contemporary hindsight, that's fine. But here is a thing that has literally never happened on a debate stage. Anyone saying, Senator Sanders, you campaigned for the Socialist Workers Party at a time when they were defending the Iranian hostage-taking of American citizens. What does that say about your judgment? Or, Senator Sanders, you supported the Nicaraguan revolutionary and dictator Daniel Ortega. You also supported the Cuban revolutionary and dictator Fidel Castro, both of whom terrorized their people and worked aggressively against American interests. What does that say about your judgment? Or, Senator Sanders, at a time when millions of political prisoners died at the hands of the Gulag Archipelago, you went to Russia for your honeymoon and came home praising the Soviet Union. What does that say about your judgment? If you want to argue that the crazy Marxist stuff Bernie believed 30 years ago doesn't matter today, that's fine. But he should have to make that argument out loud. He shouldn't just get a pass where no one even asks him about it at the same time that he's casting aspersions on people who once holding views that were comparatively mainstream, and even if they were mistaken, were several orders of magnitude less pernicious than the mistaken views Sanders once espoused. And Ray's right on the money, because Sanders has believed and has said some amazingly bad things. His judgment has been extremely bad. When challenged recently about his support for Fidel Castro, do you know what his response was? Bernie Sanders' response was, well, he wasn't all bad. He started a literacy program. Oh. That's like saying Mao Zedong was not all bad. I mean, he might have murdered millions of people, but he loved cats. Couldn't have been all bad. Bernie Sanders is not just a democratic socialist. And please understand that to stick that label on him is to expect people to be stupid. Because democratic socialism is the welcome mat. It's, I'm sorry, I have to use this illustration, but democratic socialism is the candy that the predator is waving out the window of that unmarked white van. Come on, kids, get your candy here. Because once you walk in, you're going to have to fight like hell to get out. We're watching that happen in Venezuela right now. We're watching the people of Hong Kong say, no, 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 you're not bringing that here. We're watching that happen. And we have watched it happen many times. Included in today's show notes, I don't have time to get into this today because it's lengthy, but I have two articles on the failure of socialism that I want you to read. They're both from Heritage. And they both go into detail on the failure of socialism and the historical record of three nations which tried socialism and then rejected it. Three nations. And you may be surprised when you find out which nations these were. If you're not up on history and you don't really know these things. Three nations, prominent nations, that tried socialism and rejected it. India, the UK, and Israel. Israel was actually founded on a socialist form of government, which eventually failed, and they had to abandon it. The same had... Same happened after World War II in the UK. It eventually floundered, and they abandoned it. And the same in India. Three prominent nations which are impacting the world today, which turned their backs on socialism because it was a complete failure. And they were the lucky ones. I'll include those in today's show notes. Read those two articles. That's it. God bless you. Have a good one. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the Tuesday edition of The Daily Perspective. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.